You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, we're talking with Kathy Brew. She's a curator, educator, filmmaker, and has held a number of positions. Kathy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Brainerd.
Let's talk about what it is that got you involved in the art world, because I kind of want to go through your career, but what were your beginnings in the arts, or what you think got you involved in art to begin with?
Okay, I'm a girl from New York, went to college in New England, liberal arts, but the classes that I was most turned on to were the art and art history classes. I didn't feel like I could be an art major because you had to take studio classes, and I didn't really have that history or background. Although when I think back on it, my favorite things as a little girl were being at my easel and make-believe and dress up and performing. But anyway, so I was a major in sociology, anthropology, and I minored in art history. And then I lived in New York after college in Vermont for 4 years. And I would consider that to be, in a way, sort of my postgraduate education, living in the city in the late 70s. And I just soaked in as much as I could here from, you know, going to the kitchen and, you know, which was, you know, and we're talking the late 70s when things were really different than they are now in the art world. And, you know, going to experimental performance places like, you know, the Worcester Group and Squat Theater. And I just, you know, sort of got very interested in contemporary art. I moved that Steinberg New Yorker cover from the late 70s, Nothing West of the Hudson, you know, sort of you see Russia way off in the distance. You know, my feeling at the time, I was married to my college boyfriend at the time. We both were from this region, and we'd done some traveling, but we'd never lived out of this region, and thought, gosh, if we'd been living here for 4 years after college, and it's like, if we never live someplace else, we never will. And as much as New York is a great place, and I've been back here for over 20 years, I really felt the need to have a different locus. And we moved to San Francisco, thinking it would be a two-year experiment. And
now let me just stop you there. So this is after graduating from college. You're in New York for how many years before moving to San Francisco?
4, 77 to 81.
And in that time, what kind of jobs were you doing? You sound like you're getting involved with theater, performance, seeing a lot of art in New York at that time.
Yeah, but that was just my avocation. I was working in educational publishing. I was certified to teach. What was a girl growing up in the 50s going to be? She was either going to be a teacher or a nurse. My father was a doctor or a mommy. And my father, nothing wrong with any of those professions, but it was, you know, growing up in the 50s, a girl didn't feel particular like she had a lot of options, or at least in my upbringing. But so I was working in educational publishing and AV materials, though, making educational film strips, which in hindsight, you know, no crystal ball here or 5-year or 30-year plan. But when I teach and I tell my students, you know, in media that, you know, my first work was in this Stone Age form. But the tools keep changing. And when I think about what my first job was and where I've ended up today, it's been really an interesting beginning point because it was making AV materials, picture and sound, with a very archaic form. And now here I am, you know, making documentaries with digital video. But
we're going to get to that soon. But so now you were teaching and
No, I wasn't.
And working in New York.
I was just,
now
I was
you're in
just
San
doing
Francisco.
Educational, right. So we moved out to the Bay Area. My husband had a job that allowed us to get transferred. We had gone for a trip that summer before, just checking out the Northwest, and liked the Bay Area. And he had a job where we could get transferred, so we asked for it. I thought it was going to be a 2-year experiment, and we would dash back to the hub of the universe. Lots more happened, and I stayed in the Bay Area for 14 years. My first job that I got there was working for public television, and I was, you know, in my late 20s. It was 1981 to 84 that I worked for KQED-TV, and I thought, I mean, the year I moved out there, the Village Voice did a cover article that the Bay Area, not here, was the hub of experimental theater. I think I lived in a very interesting time in the Bay Area. We all now hear about, you know, the Googlers and, you know, the dot-com and Silicon Valley. But in the 80s, there was a lot of experimentation going on out there. While I was at the PBS station, I chose the arts as my avocation and championing. And I worked on art documentaries and just kept pushing for the arts, you know, public television. Is either poverty broadcasting or petroleum broadcasting, depending on which side of the table you're on. But ultimately, I ended up leaving there a little bit disillusioned because really.
So tell me a little bit about that, because what did that mean that was a kind of a hot scene then, and why were you disillusioned?
Well, I was disillusioned at the station because they were really just going for the usual suspects and the higher end. I called it the SOBs, the Symphony Opera Ballet. Don't get me wrong. There's room for everything. But I was trying to push for the more experimental, the more, you know, avant-garde. I mean, I'll give you an example. In 1984, there was a international broadcast that Joseph Beuys and Nam June Paik and people were doing called Good Morning, Mr. Orwell. I came back to New York around Thanksgiving time and heard about it through the grapevine from friends here in New York and went back to the station, found out the station was even having a band, Oingo Boingo, on New Year's Day at the turning of 1984 performing in the studio, but the station wasn't going to connect up with this live international cultural telecast globally because it's a holiday and we'd have to pay overtime for the engineers. And it was like, you know, they just weren't as receptive or open to what I thought public television really should be. And so I ultimately migrated more into the arts. I got from the PBS station, I segued and became the director of PR and publications at the San Francisco Art Institute. Which was a great place. You know, I think it's the oldest fine art college in the country, and it was a great place to work. Students were there. Professional gallery for contemporary artists was there. Visiting artist lecture series, film programs, really interesting scene. And I liked my job there, but this was like 84, 85. That I was doing that. But again, there was lots of stuff going on. This was kind of the beginning of site-specific installation kind of taking off. And again, the Bay Area, like nothing west of the Hudson. The problem when you're on this side of the Hudson, you often don't hear about things that are interesting that are going out on that other coast. I mean, now a little bit different than then with, you know, the web and stuff. But I got asked to leave my job at the Art Institute and become the second director of this very unusual artist-in-residency program called Cap Street Project, where an art patron, Ann Hatch, had purchased this house that an artist, David Ireland, had basically redesigned in the Mission District as an art project. Ann, who came from a lineage of art philanthropy, her great-grandfather, T.B. Walker, started the Walker Art Center, decided that instead of it being, you know, just a nice place for her, that she wanted to make this be an art space to invite artists to come and make site-specific work in this very unusual architectural setting. This was not just a white box to come and put your work up in. It was come lit. People made proposals. They got, you know, slides and images of what the space was, and they had to propose what they were going to do in this unusual space. And then there was an advisory board, and a selection was made. Again, we're talking, I was the second director after a first year of artists. James Turrell was in the first year. Artists were doing really amazing things there. So I became the second director from 85 to 87. Artists were given, it was a three-month residency. They had 6 weeks to create the work. In a studio, I was the sole staff person, basically went into the house they were living in every day, was kind of the behind the scenes production manager, facilitator, wrote the grants, wrote the PR, wrote the catalog, had work study students. We had people there like Mary Lucier, Perry Hoberman, Marianne Amiche, James Lee Byers, Dillerin Scafidio. I mean, for me, the 2 years of working at Cap Street were like my going to art school. I don't have a master's. I have a master's in life from the work experience. I think at the time I came up and out into the world, it wasn't, you know, de rigueur that you had to have a master's to be in this arena. And I think I had, you know, the high school equivalency diploma of a master's in my experience working with those people. It was amazing.
That sounds amazing. Can you maybe tell us a story of working with one of those people or something particularly memorable? I mean, they're all amazing names, but James Lee Byers comes to mind.
Oh, James Lee Byers, he was probably the most unusual artist to come into the program in terms of the way he came. And I'll tell you why, because it wasn't a huge, you know, project, although it was nationally recognized, it wasn't like a blitz open call to the whole world. There was, you know, recommenders of who should apply, and then there were invitations to apply, and then there was this advisory board that came and met once a year, and I presented all the, let's say there'd be 65 proposals, and the panel would pick like the top 10, and then Anne and I would pick out of that 10 based on a range of things, and it often meant who was available, like demographics and, you know, all that kind of thing, who would come for the next year for the 4 slots. Let me also just say, at that time, artists got a $7,500 working budget and a $2,500 living stipend. So they got a $10,000 idea, basically, to come and make work for 3 months. And we did all the legwork, and then they had an exhibition.
Wow, that was a lot of money. That's a lot of money now. That must have been a small
exactly.
fortune then.
Yeah, and it was recognized nationally as sort of a fairly unique project, and I got to come back east for a conference that NYFA put on called Imaginary Needs, Creative Support for Creative Artists. It was out at Gurney's, I don't know if it was 86 or 87, one of those 2 years. But okay, so James Lee Byers, I will just tell this story. Jim Elliott, who was one of the, I guess, nominators or on the panel, instead of James Lee submitting an application like most everybody else did, Jim Elliott came to the advisory board meeting with basically a small suitcase of Byers ephemera and basically suggested him as one of the artists. And, the panel, based on his amazing work, we did invite him. So I had to call him in Europe and ask, you know, invite him. And he was like, well, I hope your doors are so many meters wide because I'm so many meters. Anyway, he was amazing to work with. He came into the space and decided for him site specificity was to engage in people and philosophical question. We went off on, you know, looking for black bamboo. I mean, it's so hard to recreate it. He was like a shaman. He created an environment, an atmosphere. He activated it with performance out in the, like a forest in the Presidio. You know, he would call me up at all days and hours of the night and say, you know, one time he had nicknames for me. Listen, Golden Dragon, please wear red and black tomorrow. And I would, because it was fun and interesting. And he would do all this stuff. I mean, I have a box of ephemera from James. I mean, the thing for me that was amazing, too, is many of these people, because I was so intimately involved with the behind-the-scenes part of their work, they became really important mentors and friends. I mean, I continued to stay in touch with James Lee all the way till when he was, you know, dying in Egypt. So Marianne Amiche, another amazing artist who activated the space each week with performances and structure-born sound and, you know, a big article came out, The Alchemist on Cap Street. Paul Koss, who decided, he had a unique proposal. He said, I cannot make a proposal in advance for something site-specific. I have to be in the site to determine what I'm going to do. And again, the panel respected that as an answer instead of like this big five-year plan of what he was going to do. And he made an amazing piece. He was there during the time of Lent leading up to Easter. We were in the Mission District. It had a loading dock door. He, from his Wyoming upbringing, he decided he wanted to do a sculptural bell ringing piece. So every day at noon, the loading dock door was open, and we had these gorgeous bells. I ended up being one of the bell ringers. We did this change ringing every day at noon, like churches. And if you were there, you got it. And if you didn't, you didn't. But in fact, Paul cited James Lee Byers an earlier piece called The Perfect Kiss is one of his inspirations for that idea, because that's a piece James did at Berkeley where he stood up, he walked out at noon onto a marked square cube on the floor, blew a kiss, and went away. And if you were there, you saw it. And if you were, you know, these kinds of things. So, I mean, it just really was an amazing two-year experience. What can I say? So then I migrated
That is amazing. So that was before you went to Manhattan, of course. And then right after that, excuse me, which as you're saying is kind of like getting an extraordinary education, then you moved to Manhattan. And why did you leave Manhattan?
No, then? I stayed in the Bay Area. That was 85 to 87. I didn't move back to New York until 94. I continued to work in media and the arts. I was the managing director of a performing arts space called Life on the Water after Cap Street, where they wanted me to help actually bring sort of the visual art aspect of performance to their space. So we did, again, some amazing things. I brought Karen Finley out there. I had a film screening with Mark Pauline, activating the theater seats in a sort of strange way to go along with the film. Anyway, I worked with George Coates, who was doing experimental avant-garde theater using multimedia. I was the curator of the Mill Valley Video Festival portion of their film. I mean, I just did a lot of things. I worked with Lynn Hirschman on some of her projects. I was just this kind of hybrid after probably Life on the Water. So I moved back in 94. For a job in the art world.
That was a pretty exciting and formative time in the Bay Area. I mean, that's where you really kind of got your, you know, sea legs, sort of, so to speak, in the art world. You're meeting all these amazing personalities and artists and producing, you know, exhibitions and all kinds of things.
Right. And I think, you know, maybe a little bit of the, you know, and I'm from here, but I think that I got opportunities. I was kind of in the right place at the right time. I got to do things out there that I probably would have never gotten to do here, and it changed who I am. And I say I'm sort of, you know, bi-coastal schizophrenic. This is in my blood, and that got under my skin. And yes, you're completely right. I mean, from the ages of 28 to 41, living out there and doing the work I did was very, very formative for who I am and what I got to do. I also worked on independent documentaries. Actually, from 91, I worked on a documentary about widows of the Vietnam War called Regret to Inform. We went to Vietnam for 5 weeks, and actually that film, I was the line producer for that film, and that won Best Documentary at Sundance in the late 90s. So, again, my whole career has kind of been this hybridity of kind of out there avant-garde contemporary art and then social issues stuff. So I kind of run the spectrum depending on what's going on at a given time.
Well, so now we're moving to New York, right? We're talking about the Bay Area, but then what happened when you got to New York?
So I moved back to New York for a job in the art world, and I'm not going to get into it too much. I was actually asked to be the director of a commercial gallery, which I had never done in my life. You know, I certainly know gallerists and go to galleries, but that my background was more in the nonprofit arts and, you know, selling ideas and promoting artists, but not selling stuff. And but I wanted to come back here. I felt like, you know, okay, I thought it was only going to be 2 years. It was 14. I actually, towards the end, I felt like I had fished out the pond. It changed who I was, but things were shifting. And my final metaphor in the Bay Area was I was scraping my skull on a glass ceiling and drowning in beauty. You know, I just felt like I wasn't going to – people entrench in there. There's not the same, you know, mobility or shifts and changes. So I had already envisioned I wanted to come back, but I was, you know, I wasn't just going to get on a plane and move back. So I moved back for a job to be a director of a commercial gallery that was a little bit dicey. And 3 months out, it became clear that that wasn't going to work. So I wasn't. In the winter of 95, I found myself, you know, I moved back in September, like without a job and kind of wondering if I was going to move back to the Bay Area because I moved so quickly. I put my stuff in storage, left my car with my ex-husband, sublet my place and came here. But when that job crashed, I thought, you know what, I'm from here. This is my roots. I want to be back here. The universe brought me back here for a reason. I'm not exactly sure, but I've got to give it more time. At that time, I had gone to an art table event with Carolee Schneemann, who's a good friend, and we had a drink afterwards with Amay Wallach, who heard about what my background was and said, oh, there's this TV series that's just started up called City Arts. Your background seems perfect for that. You should get in touch with them. I didn't even have a TV, but I got in touch with them, and they were like, oh, sorry, we've staffed up for the season. We'll keep your resume on file, and, you know, good luck. So I had a very cold winter in 1995, and I, again, before the internet and email, but I was writing to anybody I knew, like, not even just give me a job, but I'm looking for work if you know of anything project-based. I wasn't coming up with that much. I was getting freelance work out of the city more with my San Francisco contacts. I went to Texas and worked on a project with the artist Michael Tracy. I went out to Sun Valley, Idaho, and worked on somebody's independent film. But so the summer of 95, I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back out to California. I'm going to pack up my stuff. I'm going to come back here, and I'm going to give it a good try in the fall. I almost like in New York, people kind of go fishing a little bit. It's not as, you know, easy to find. Things do slow down here in the summer, not that entirely, but 2 days before I was going to go out west, I got a phone call from Channel 13 that was doing the series City Arts. I mean, how many times do you hear, I'm going to keep your resume on file, and you think it's just gone in the garbage, right?
Well,
I get this call saying, hi, we're staffing up for the second season, and we're going through this notebook of resumes, and yours looks really appropriate. When would you like to come in for an interview? And I said, how about tomorrow? I'm getting on a plane the next day. Went in and had an interview with the producer of the series, had never seen the show because I didn't have a TV, talked about ideas for what I would think about for, like, art segments. And the guy said, well, I liked your ideas. Fax me what we've talked about and call me from the coast. So I was out west, you know, packing my stuff out of storage, blah, blah, blah. Get this call saying, well, we really liked your ideas. Here's what I'm going to propose. You come back and you start up with us for the second season. And one of many things could happen. It either doesn't work or we like you and you come on board as part of the staff, or we ask you to do some independent producing. I was going to do a drive away and take my leisurely time coming back east. All of a sudden, I couldn't do that. So I knew I needed to get back here and get my foot in the door, and so I did. And then I worked on this art series for Channel 13 for 2 seasons. It was, you had a job for half a year, and then you didn't. And I don't know if you ever saw that series, but it was a really great magazine show. And what was really good about it was the segments were done by independent producers. And it was the opposite of what I'm saying about what I was resentful about at the big PBS station in San Francisco. It was all disciplines and high and low. So you could have symphony, opera, ballet, but you could have street art, and you could have new media art and performance art. And the segments were short.
Oh, yeah, it was a great series. I mean, I do know it. I was actually profiled on it when I was living in the East Village doing work as an artist.
Right.
They were... did a wonderful piece. Great series, yeah.
Well, and frankly, it's a shame that it doesn't still exist. A city like New York should have a show like that as a constant. But so that was actually a really great way for me to, after the crash and burn of the job that didn't work out, it was a really great way for me to plug back into being back in New York, because even though I was from here and had always kept coming back, and even you know, though I did what I did out west, it's sort of, New York is also a little bit punishing. It's like, so what, you've done those interesting things out there. You got to get back in the back of the line here and eat some pavement and prove your chops on this coast. So anyway, the thing was, it was a very good way to reenter being back here, because I was on the receiving end of pretty much the art world in all its forms that wanted to get coverage on, you know, this show. And I championed, again, more contemporary, more cutting edge. I was, you know, pushed for a segment on new media, you know, just trying to get past just, you know, the usual suspects. And so it was a really good way to get resituated back here and plugged into, you know, all this, just the scene. But it was seasonal. So I had a job for half a year, and then I didn't. And then I got asked back for a second season, which was their third. And at that point, then I was getting more plugged into places and people. And so in the fall of 1996, somebody told me, oh, there's this new nonprofit initiative that's starting up. It's a consortium of organizations, NYFA, Harvest Works, Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. They're realizing that, you know, Silicon Alley is bubbling here and art and technology is kind of a big thing and artists are ahead of the curve and we want to raise more visibility for that. And they're looking for a new director for this initiative and maybe you want to throw your hat in the ring. And I was like, oh my God, nonprofit art situation in New York City in the late 90s. It was different when I was doing Cap Street in the mid 80s. You know, the economic, this was after, you know, the NEA folded and, you know, I was like, I'm not so sure. But I actually realized that I was not going to have a job come January of 97. And so I did throw my hat in the ring. And it turns out I got the job. I remember the interview.
So before we talk about that job and that interview, because I want to hear about that. In City Art, since you talked a little bit about James Lee Byers and, you know, in the incarnation before that, is there a memorable story or production you worked on for City Art? I know there must have been tons, but is there one that comes to mind immediately?
Well, actually, the segment that comes to mind the most for me was actually one that my partner and subsequent husband, Roberto Guerra, and I produced after I was staff. Then we were independent producers for some segments ourselves. When I was on staff, I was more like behind the scenes supporting the independent producers and helping sort of mastermind what the segments were. I did a few short pieces then called Selects. It'd be like five things you can go see this week. But once I wasn't on staff, then we produced like three or four pieces for them. And we produced one piece on PS1's reopening when it did its whole big redesign. And that was a blast to do. I mean, we had people in it like James Turrell and Julian Schnabel and Brendan Gill. And we won an Emmy for that. And we also did another really fun piece, Artist Space, celebrating their 25th anniversary. And the way to really capitalize on that was we piggybacked on a Vanity Fair shoot that pulled in all of these amazing artists for the 25th anniversary from, you know, Vito Acconci and Elizabeth Murray and Chuck Close and Cindy Sherman and Jeff, you know, so we interviewed all those people. So those are my more, you know, after I was on staff, those are my fun memories. But yeah, I mean, we did amazing, you know. Again, for me, that was a different kind of reentry to New York, get your feet wet really well as a way to segue into what was going to come next without having the master plan for it. I mean, none of them, I've never had, in fact,
right.
When I went for the interview for Thunder Gulch, which was part of LMCC, this group interview asked me at one point, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I said, look, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be flip, but I don't live life that way. I can't answer that, you know. And then look what happened 5 years later. I mean, we can get to that, but, you know, 9/11, who had that
right.
Crystal ball.
So now it's Thunder Gulch, and what was your role there, and how did that evolve?
Well, again, I heard about the job. I thought, I don't really want to do it. Of nonprofit, you know, administrative. I mean, I like working more directly with the art and the artists. And yes, a lot of these kind of jobs involve, you know, other things. But when you're like the director of something, it's like fundraising and all these other things that aren't necessarily the more fun part. But ultimately, I did throw my hat in the ring and I did get the position. So it was a program of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. But initially, my office was in this Rudin building that was called the New York Information Technology Center, way down on Broad Street. And I had this small office and all these boxes of what this consortium of people thought this organization should be. And it was like, you know, exhibition possibilities and residencies and online revenue for artists. And this was before, you know, e-commerce was even functioning. But so I was in this building and with mostly either satellite versions of higher end techie corporations like Sun Microsystems or small startups. I was probably the only certainly the only cultural nonprofit in the building. They had a big video wall in the lobby. They had T1 connectivity, and I knew like to really get something going from the ground up with ideas, it was going to take a while. But I was like, okay, but artists are already doing things. And again, this was before galleries like Bitforms that, you know, now show digital art, or even museums who have, it's like, okay, the artists are doing stuff. Let me ask the building if I can use their video wall and start having almost like these salon presentations in this lobby like once a week. So they said yes. So we started this series called At the Wall with the at sign. And, you know, artists came and were presenting like, you know, interactive installations or robotic sculpture, and sort of in these salon show and tell presentations, and audiences started to come. And it wasn't just the Cognoscenti, because it was in this sort of tech across near the New York Stock Exchange. So it was like sort of downtown workers. I mean, years ago, the downtown Whitney, when it was way downtown, was doing this kind of programming to try to expose, you know, just the local community to this kind of work too. So I'm not, this wasn't a novel idea, but it was how I felt like I could get some traction for the organization and visibility for the artist and take it from there. So it did start to get attention and take off. And then because I didn't really have a physical space, I started partnering with other organizations that were doing new media and digital programming, but doing things to augment it. So let's say the Whitney was doing a digital show, but they weren't having a panel. So I would organize a panel, and we would do it, oh, at the New School or the Kitchen. I was like a cyber squatter. I didn't really have a proper space. I was in that building for a couple of years, maybe a year and a half. And then Lower Manhattan Cultural Council's offices were actually at 5 World Trade Center. And when I had first started, Jenny Dixon was the director, but by the time this other occurrence occurred, there was a new director, Liz Thompson. And finally she said, you know, I think we need to consolidate, and you need to come, you know, instead of us paying rent over there, you should come and be in our offices. And so I did. So I moved over into 5 World Trade Center. And at that time, this other program had started underway, World Views, where they had asked the Port Authority to have access to some of the unbuilt out office space in Tower 1 to have residencies for artists. And initially it started as a very kind of, I would say, conservative program because of where we were dealing with. And it was called World Views, and the idea was what artists would do by being up there looking out their window, so either painting or drawing or photography or maybe sculpture. And so that's, it started off kind of very safely. And then a new curator came on board and opened it up more to, you know, all contemporary art practice. So as that was happening, then I was like, well, hey, what about, you know, for lack of a better, new media artists? You know, okay, so there aren't computers up there and there's not connectivity, but these artists, you know, just need time and studio and context, and, you know, they probably have what they need on their own computers at home, but they need this other. So we started to have a separate jury for Thunder Gulch artists, and I actually worked out an arrangement so if they didn't have what they needed, they could go. I was teaching at the School of Visual Arts in the computer art department, and they could go and have access to some of the facilities there. So we started having separate residencies at the same time as the overall World Views that were for these quote-unquote new media artists. So our first two artist slots for that were Stephen Vitiello, sound artist, and Kevin and Jennifer McCoy. Now, what's really interesting about both of those projects is, fast forward after 9/11, both of those projects had some kind of strange resonance and power that took on more meaning after 9/11. Stephen Vitiello decided, I want to make work that pulled in the sound from up here and airplanes and all the, just the, and he put spy mics on the windows. Well, as we know what happened after, I mean, the Whitney ended up buying that piece. I mean,
I remember he also recorded the sound actually of the building swaying, I think.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. He so, yeah. That was the first Thunder Gulch residency, along with the McCoys, who did a piece called Air World, where they were spoofing kind of the corporatization of websites and logos, and they set up a whole construct in the studios. They had like an office. They had their logo was two airplanes. They did performative things in video, and those were the two first residencies.
For some people who don't understand this, I just want to say these residencies that you're talking about, these are LMCC residencies that took place in the World Trade Center
Tower. They took place on the 91st floor of Tower 1. Artists had 5 months of 24-hour access to, again, this section on the 91st floor that was unbuilt out office space that they could come in and go anytime. You know, they weren't expected to live there. I go in coma. I mean, there's a whole lineage of who was all there over the years.
But there was one project that seemed very memorable to me that because of 9/11 was, you never heard from it again, but the collaborative group Gelatin was also, I think, almost at the time or maybe just before the second residency during 9/11, they had built, presumably, or it seemed very real, they removed one of the windows on the 91st
yes.
floor, and they built a balcony out on there and took photographs. And I remember seeing
yep.
it in the New York Times. I think it was on the cover of the art section in August of you know, just before 9/11. And it seemed extraordinary. And I remember, like, Mukhtar Kokesh and people from LMCC were like, you know, we don't know anything about that. And people
right.
from the World Trade Center were saying, if that's true, you know, they're in a lot of trouble. And it seemed like it absolutely was true. I mean, I have that book, and that
It was true. But also, well, and also, again, then, of course, there are a couple of other projects. Monica Bravo, who was in the residency program at the time, you know, leading up to and the attacks, the day before 9/11 was, there was this big storm, and she was shooting video and time-lapse of the storm. And she went, the night before, she was actually almost going to leave the material there, but she decided to go home and bring it with her. And then one artist who did stay overnight to keep working on his work, Michael Richards, stayed overnight and did die. And I don't know if you know his story, but he was originally from Jamaica, black sculptor. I think he was his day job, he worked up at the Studio Museum in Harlem and also worked with other artists. Anyway, one of his signature pieces that he was working on a series of sculptures about the Tuskegee Airmen, the African-American pilots in World War II. And one of his signature sculptures, their photos of him standing with it, was of a pilot being pierced by an airplane.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, very eerie.
So anyway, I ran Thunder Gulch from 97 till a little bit after 2001. And in all honesty, in all respect, it was a good time to be doing it when new media was kind of bubbling up and, again, not as incorporated into contemporary art practice, but I felt like I was almost in, LMCC is a great organization, but right before 9/11, the director came to me and said, oh, for the next board meeting, I need all your 2-year art and public technology public programs. And I was like, she came out of the dance world. And I remember saying to her, you know, it's changing under our feet. That would actually be irresponsible to say what's happening in 2 years. It's moving much quicker than that. It's not like booking Twyla and Trisha and Merce, but, well, I still need something. And then 9/11 happened. And I was actually trying to think about possibly migrating the idea of Thunder Gulch more to maybe kind of like what Martha Wilson's done with Franklin Furnace, collaborating with, she's moved at Franklin Furnace to be affiliated with Pratt. And I was thinking about maybe trying to look into something like that with Thunder Gulch before 9/11 happened, because I just felt like the fit with LMCC wasn't going to take it forward. And then 9/11 happened, and, you know, I basically was asked to leave. It was sort of like, well, we've got to rebuild from the ground up. And you know, art and technology isn't going to be our first thought. And I also felt like my metaphor was, I was in an arranged marriage, the house exploded, so why go back to bed? I sort of said, I can't go back to, you know, literally ground zero and build up what I started in 1997 from boxes from a consortium. So I, you know, I moved on.
And so that brings us nearly up to the present with your filmmaking and the documentary you were doing on your late husband, Roberto. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, for the next couple of years after I left 9/11, we were working on projects. We did something. We a lot more still like art-related. Almost we were commissioned to do a video when Exit Art had this show called Paradise Now, picturing the genetic revolution. Actually, that was in 2000, before 9/11. We collaborated with Merrill Eucalys on a video installation about the Fresh Kills landfill, a six-channel, multi-channel piece. We were commissioned by MIT Media Lab to do another sort of video art catalog that we created, like a documentary about a exhibit called Identity Portraits in the 21st Century. So I was doing freelance, you know, and our independent work with Roberto, but then I also was feeling a little bit stressed of, I guess, maybe the economic aspect, and thought maybe a job would actually be a good thing. And I was feeling like I still care about art and technology and new media. And again, my trajectory has been basically media and contemporary art and all it's expanded in different kinds of forms. I've been on NISCA's electronic media and film program and, you know, a nominator for new media art fellowships for Rockefeller, a lot of different things. But in my own practice, the documentary work is really more my thing than the new tech stuff. And so I actually took a job for longer than I thought. I was the co-director of the Margaret Mead Film Festival at the Museum of Natural History from 2004 to 2007. Because I thought, like, gee, if, you know, if I can't support myself full time doing documentaries, maybe it'd be good to get off the esoteric art tech branch and be more in this world and just plug in this other way internationally. And so I did that. And I also, we did art and science programming. And I tried to keep bringing, you know, my own experience and knowledge and influences to some of the programming we did there. And even with the Mead Festival, I brought in, like, you know, new media programming to the festival as well. But basically in 2007, after doing it for 4 years, it was like, you know, I'm not in my 20s or 30s. This is great, but I don't need to keep doing this. And that's when I actually decided that if I wanted to do my own work with Roberto, that I couldn't have a full-time job, and that I was teaching adjunct at SVA, and that, you know, maybe I could give it a stab and do what I really wanted to do. I mean, not that all of this is kind of fed into what I still do, but I didn't want to be on the sort of institutional side anymore. So from 2007 on, I have been doing independent film and teaching at the School of Visual Arts and the New School.
And so I think last, I'd love to talk a little bit about the documentary you did on Roberto.
No, I didn't do a documentary on Roberto. We did a documentary on, that's out in the world right now. We did a documentary on Lella and Massimo Vignelli. It's called Design is One, Lella and Massimo Vignelli. It's on Netflix. It's an international distribution and national distribution. And it was just in Beirut last week. It's going to be on Swedish television coming up. There's a website, www.designisonefilm.com, that has the trailer and the screening history and all kinds of other things, and links to some of our other projects in the bios page. But that's the current work that's getting traction out in the world. And fortunately, it was completed before Roberto got struck out of the blue with pancreatic cancer, and it got completed while both Lella and Massimo were in good form. 5 months after Roberto died, Massimo died. Lella is either suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's or aphasia. So luckily we captured them all, you know, while everybody was still well. So as Peter Eisenman says in the closing credits, will it matter 100 years from now? Yes. And that's what's important, because as a curator at MoMA says, everybody knows the Vignellis, even if you don't know you know them, because you know something they've done. And their principles of design, I think, carry over. I just am having my SVA computer art students watch it next week, because I think, you know, even though it's not talking about, you know, digital art, I mean, their principles of design, I think, carry over into any kind of creative thinking and practice.
Well, there'll be links in this interview, of course, so people can see that and watch it. And Kathy, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent with me today.
Well, I want to thank you, Brainerd. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.